Louisa, welcome back to the Old Mole Variety Hour.
Thanks for having me.
In our July program, you made some points that haven't widely been part of the ongoing discussion of police reform. I'm going to attempt to summarize them just for the sake of efficiency and then give you a chance to amplify or clarify what you think I've left out. You pointed out that historically, when police unions have been formed, police killings increase, and that's especially true of police killings of Black people. You understood that. You suggested we understand that in terms of the lessening accountability. Police are held less accountable when they have a union formed to defend them. You pointed out that many of the relevant provisions governing policing are not in the union contracts, but rather in the manuals of practice that are actually management, that is, local government documents. So you made the very strong point and the very interesting point that killings and brutality are not simply attributable to the police, but to local government efforts to control and suppress populations. As an experienced public sector bargainer, I'm going on with summarizing some of our conversation from that earlier July episode of Another World is Possible. As an experienced public sector bargainer, you pointed out that bargaining should be public and that legislation at the state level can change, could reduce the areas in which people are entitled, in which unions are entitled to bargain, that some of those areas could be cut back in the case of police unions. Our discussion recognized the possibility that right-wing forces could use this effort to cut back on the wide range of bargaining for police unions to attack all public sector unions. But resisting that attack, and this is where our discussion ended up, resisting that attack and making clear what we won't stand for in police practice is an opportunity to revitalize the labor movement by clarifying what we do or what we should stand for. Now, Louisa, that's been a lot to take in. Would you like to amplify or clarify?
So I would say it's not just an opportunity, it's also an obligation that we have, particularly to our Black union brothers and sisters, and also the way that some elements of the labor movement has treated non-white union employees historically. I would say that it's not just an opportunity, it's also an obligation. I mean, I think if there's ever a good time, it would certainly be now in terms of taking a stand on police accountability and trying to legislate out of existence all the special rights that they've been able to get for themselves, including stuff like special pensions, police do have.
And use that as an opportunity to focus on what our labor movement is or should be, what we should be standing for.
Yeah, exactly.
The kind of criteria that we would bring to bear on police unions. Our takeoff point today is the police accountability measure that's on the Portland ballot. We're airing the day before the election, so we don't know whether that's passed or not. But let me ask you, Louisa, under the best possible scenarios, if this measure is passed, if it survives court challenges, and if the state legislature follows up and does what the measure calls on it to do, what would this police accountability measure accomplish? And then we'll go on after that and talk about the dangers it might bring and what it wouldn't accomplish. But first of all, what would it do?
It would give the jurisdiction to community oversight committees to be able to discipline police officers. They could investigate, they could compel testimony, that type of thing. So it would put into the hands of community members the right to that particular right, which is essentially to discipline and terminate.
You've suggested in our conversations that One of the dangers in passing a police accountability measure is that it supports the notion that bad practices by the police are the exception.
Right. Yeah. And it ignores what the social role of police actually are. So those of us who know our history understand that police were a product of slave patrols. And so what the function of police is to protect private capital. You know, it's certainly having a civilian oversight committee really focuses on, you know, the kind of bad apples without, as you and I state, getting to all of the other problems that are caused by too many police.
In another episode of Another World is Possible, I want to explore at much greater depth how it is that the kind of social economic arrangements we have, how neoliberal capitalism requires increasing repression and requires a militarized police, that they go together, and also that militarization, that repression, is racialized in multiple ways. You've raised these issues now. How do you understand them?
There is a really particularly brilliant and accessible essay by a man named Boots Riley, who's a rapper from The Coup. He summarizes it really well, and he says that, you know, you under capitalism, you can't have full employment, right? That gives workers too much power. And so capitalism necessitates unemployment. And so those of us who have taken, you know, college level or even high school level economics classes, you know, unemployment is seen as some natural thing. You know, it's like inflation. We don't really understand it, but it exists. Under capitalism, you kind of have to have a group of unemployed workers so that bosses can keep wages low by threatening workers with the idea that they're going to be replaced. And so the bigger that group of people is, what we label competition, flexibility, whatever, the lower that wages are. You know, as far as most employers are concerned, the point is to keep wages as low as they possibly can. Alternatively, if there was full employment, workers could say, I want $75, you know, an hour or I'm out, and the boss really couldn't replace them. The point is that capitalism needs an army of unemployed workers in order to exist.
And how is that racialized?
Well, I mean, I could take myself for an example. I was an undocumented immigrant until I was just about 21 years old. And so I had to work under the table. Because of my immigration status, it necessitated me working under the table. And so something that should be really straightforward, like the ability to drive or work, became politicized because of essentially a racist and a bureaucratic immigration system. You know, there's lots of instances where people are forced to find alternative forms of work because of a pervasively racist criminal justice system that disproportionately punishes Black people and brown people in a way that it doesn't with whites.
Where do we go from here? What kind of a vision of what public safety could be like do we have to offer?
You know, when you talk to advocates of police reform and particularly police abolition, what they implore people to consider is, you know, redirecting funds that would otherwise go to police into public services, right? And so we've heard that those of us who are interested in this type of thing, we hear that over and over again. One thing that might be equally successful is just kind of, as you say, presenting a vision in terms of what community policing actually looks like. And so, you know, one of my favorite examples is Cuba. And Cuba, following the revolution, had this idea of this kind of democratic superstructure where people participated directly in resolving their own problems, right? And that was really the point. Particularly with the Lo Comité de Defensa de Revolución, the CDRs, you know, they focus on a lot of things. They're neighborhood-based organizations, and they are concerned with all kinds of local issues, neighborhood aesthetics, health and social issues, and crime control. And they do a wide berth of things. They have regular meetings, block meetings. You know, they help elders, do fixes around their houses, that type of thing. But most importantly, everybody has a relationship with one another. And so they can address neighborhood crime control in a way that's far more effective than having an outside person come in and just kind of respond to the issue the way that police do in the United States.
The example I like best is the Seattle General Strike, when workers themselves ran the city and there was no crime. Unarmed vets returning from the war patrolled the city. The police didn't come out of their barracks. And for all the days of the strike, all the days that workers stayed away from their jobs, there simply was no crime at all in the city. Those suggest some of the kind of criteria that I think that you just raised as well. And we can reiterate the criteria, but let's turn and talk about the obstacles first to change. Always we see as conditions worsen, there's a tendency to double down on what's seen to be before as past solutions, solutions in quotes. We've, of course, already talked about police unions as obstacles. Social transitions are difficult. So let me ask you, this is a question that you've posed to me at times, when people come up to you and they say, well, what are we supposed to do when there's a home invasion? What's your thinking about how to respond to that kind of question?
It's a difficult question. Crimes are different in differently constituted societies. Ultimately, I can speak for Cuba. You know, I've heard Cuban authorities say, well, you know, we need something like police, even if we don't call it that, even if they function very, very differently in Cuba than they would in another country. Ultimately, you need to be able to respond to white terrorism. But I think I would urge us to consider what comfort are we getting from having, or what's the subtext of the question? And the subtext of the question is, ultimately, I'm afraid, right? And I want to be able to lay my comfort in an authority that will respond to something like a home invasion. And I think part of why crime is much lower in Cuba than it is in other countries in Latin America is, again, kind of coming back to this idea of direct participation in resolving their problems. This idea that it's not just about redistributing wealth, but this idea that we're going to release everybody's creativity and participation in society. And I think people find comfort in police because self-determination, these types of things like these community organizations, this neighborhood organizations, where you're meeting and you're solving your own problems, that's scary. That type of freedom comes with the type of guarantee, a lack of guarantee that the police provide. But it doesn't mean that we shouldn't move toward it. And it doesn't mean that we shouldn't aspire to kind of move in that direction as a society.
Social transitions are difficult and people resist because there are consequences. There are costs. I think of kind of my family background long, long ago. Freeing of the serfs. There were serfs, many, many in Russia, who did not want to be freed as they understood what was happening. Or in U.S. labor history, some of the main events that we celebrate, major sit-down strikes in the 30s that formed the CIO, when you look closely at them, it's a minority of workers who are participating. Others are simply, well, it's fearful, what you've just been saying, Luisa. It's difficult to imagine a new situation of forming a union where you're taking responsibility for control over your workplace or partial control over your workplace. It's only after contracts are won in that kind of a situation that people jump on board and join the union. Transitions are difficult. To summarize quickly where we've come to, one, the kinds of problems that we face are a function of the kind of society overall that we have, that simply reforming the police is going to require much larger social change to get an alternative, to get a real alternative vision of what public safety should be. Two, that there will be difficulties in that transition. They'll require organizing well ahead of time. When we talk about just transition, for instance, around environmental issues, as well as kind of prefiguring. We'll have to come up with solutions we can partly bring into this society that persuade people that alternatives really are possible. That's where we've got to so far in the conversation. I want to mention another facet, which is we've talked about police and how they function vis-a-vis racial minorities in this society and how they defend property rights. What about police versus those who want to bring about change, whether minority or not? What about police versus the left? Something to say there?
Yeah, I mean, police are essentially an arm of the state. We could see very clearly as a result of national rebellions, especially as they took place in Portland.
Well, what I'm thinking of is in my time in Portland, these many decades, there have been repeated discoveries that police were engaged in illegal surveillance, illegal infiltration of left groups, of groups interested in social change, who were not committing any crimes. There have been red squads, you know, gathering information, monitoring activity oriented towards social change in an effort to repress it. When they've been discovered, the police have vowed each time, this has been a repeated pattern, that, oh, we're disbanding that group and we're destroying the files. And then a few years down the road, we discover that they've been doing the same thing under a different name. They've been discovered and they make the same vows. And then a few years down the road, again, because I've been in Portland for a while, we find out that's simply part of their function. That's part of what they do in society. These red squads, keeping track of, trying to repress efforts at social change. And so the question is, what role do police play in the society? And Louisa, you've answered that earlier. It's to defend the status quo, basically, to protect property and to repress efforts at change and to repress racial minorities necessary for the continued functioning of the economic system. So that takes us back to this police accountability measure. You raised earlier that it's been criticized as reformist, which means not having the potential to bring about real change. Can you say more about what that criticism is?
Well, like I said, a lot of it comes from that graphic produced by Critical Resistance. I don't know your feelings about whether, you know, how much of a distinction there is between a reform and a revolutionary charge. At the end of the day, if this measure were to pass, at the very least, it would be a gesture, right? It would be a sign that the majority of people in Portland believe that there needs to be stronger accountability.
To answer your question you posed to me, I don't accept the distinction between reformist reforms or supposedly revolutionary reforms. Any reform can be co-opted. Some reforms have more potential than others, but there's no reform that's per se revolutionary. The distinction I would make is it depends on how you work with the reform. And I think that's what you're getting at when you talk about how this accountability measure, if it's passed, opens up possibilities for us to go further. But in order to do that, we have to let people know, people have to understand the limits. And that's what we've been trying to do with precisely this broadcast. The police accountability measure, if it's passed the day after you're hearing this broadcast, is a starting point for us. We can go a lot further, and we would need to. Louisa, the last word goes to you.
Well, right. And I would add that in order for real change to occur, it would require the participation of other labor unions, because the rights of cops, cop unions, are so tied up with the rights of other union members that we would need a unified force to be able to say that cops don't have the right to murder unarmed Black people. And this is the movement that's going to change that. But like I said, because all of these rights are so intimately related, it would require that type of coalition work at the state level in order to get real reforms, I would argue.
And so the struggle continues. This is Norm Diamond. I've been joined wonderfully by or with Louisa Herrera. And this has been Another World is Possible.